The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program, the 1926 Census of Ireland. It's getting very close now, less than a month to go until the full 1926 census returns go online. And when they become available, they'll offer an extraordinary snapshot of Irish society a century ago.
It will get people talking again and exploring and kind of excavating jobs and places and people and communities.
Tonight, we'll explore what historians expect to find in the census and what it can tell us about life here in the aftermath of the revolutionary period. And we begin this evening at the National Archives, where our producer, Lorcan Clancy, has been finding out more about the historical importance of the 1926 census and the process of bringing it online.
We know that a lot of people have been waiting for this for a very long time. We know a lot of people are really excited because we also know it's a census whereby we can look back and we'll be able to identify, hopefully, grandparents and great-grandparents, people we actually remember.
What the individual census forms tell is the personal human story. We have the overall data, but it's that personal information, the stuff that's going to be meaningful to people on a human level, that's going to be released in a couple of weeks by the National Archives.
The team here have been intensively working on this for over 3 years now, cataloguing, conserving and digitising hundreds of thousands of pages. The final step in the process is transcribing every single handwritten census return from 1926. OCR technology helps with that, generating transcripts of each form, which are now being checked and corrected by dozens of staff.
Who are doing this human-in-the-loop, manually checking the head of household names, the first names and the surnames, and then every single name is being checked to make sure that it's correct, to make sure that the spelling is correct and identifiable. Because that's your lead point into trying to find somebody, is their name.
Zoe Reid is Keeper of Manuscripts at the National Archives and the person leading the development of the website, where we'll soon be able to access all this material.
And even if you're not related to somebody who potentially could be in the census, you live in a street or you live in a town or you live in a village that's going to be in the census. So you're going to find out what your village, town, street looked like 100 years ago. You're going to get that sense of where Ireland was in the early years of the state. It's still an infant state. It's only 4 years since the foundation of the state. And I think that moment is something really to be celebrated. But that's why everybody, I think, will be incredibly excited and curious. There's a huge amount of things just to explore. And that's what the online platform will enable people to do.
That online platform at nationalarchives.ie will go live in just 27 days. It will show the names, ages, occupations, addresses, the birthplaces and other details of almost 3 million people who were in the Irish Free State on the night of the 18th of April, 1926.
It's not the first Irish census, but it's the first census of an independent Ireland, though it only covered the 26 counties of the Irish Free State rather than the whole island, as previous censuses had done. But this was the first independent census, and I think that gives it a significance that is worth dwelling upon in its own right.
John Gibney is an assistant editor with the RIA's Documents on Irish Foreign Policy programme. He's co-editing the upcoming book, The Story of Us, a collection of case studies from the census, covering subjects like the Gaeltacht, the Anglo-Irish aristocracy, the revolutionary generation, and the patterns of human life, patterns like migration.
Birthplaces show up, say, internal migration. One trend evident in the years prior to the 1926 census was the increase in the population of Irish towns and cities as people moved from the country to the city, but it also registers immigration into the Irish Free State. There would have been an immigrant population within the Free State, which is kind of surprising when you think of the Free State as basically a monocultural society almost, you know. Now, most of those would have been, say, from the United States or from Britain itself. But then you get other categories, you know. You would have, say, 144 people from Belgium. You would have 564 from South Africa and 129 from other countries in Africa. You even have 184 people born at sea. And sometimes you would get kind of striking instances such as, say, Egyptian sailors who filled in the census form while their ship was moored in Cork. The census also gives an insight into religion, for example, you know, and the categories of religions that were broken down. You would have, say, Protestant Episcopalians, Presbyterians, Methodists, Jews, Catholics, Baptists. There's a category of others, and amongst those others might be a fella in Dublin who recorded his religion on the census form as, I quote, the mystical body of Christ.
It's that type of detail on an individual census form that will illustrate the human stories behind the statistics.
It's a moment in Irish history in terms of it's the first census of the Free State. It's a moment in the history of the National Archives because we've done this all ourselves internally in terms of all the different steps and processes. When the census website goes live, it's free to access, and that's been made possible by the funding we've received from government. And that's a really important thing because it means it's democratically available to everybody. It's not behind a paywall, and people have the ability to access it and look up the records that belong to the citizens of the state.
And remember, most people don't make an impact on history necessarily. There's a long tradition of writing what scholars used to call history from below, the history of ordinary people. But very often, like the lives we lead, they're only registered in the records of officialdom, and it might leave a fleeting trace, but that one trace matters, you know. And I think that's what gives the census form such a power, you know. There's people who might never be recorded by historians, might only exist within family memory, but here you have the census as one of a handful of other official records that can pin down something of their existence and the lives that they led.
Lorcan Clancy was reporting there. He was talking to John Gibney and Zoe Reid at the National Archives of Ireland. I'm joined now by Patrick O'Donovan, Minister for Arts, Culture, Communications, Media and Sport. You're very welcome indeed, Minister, to the History Show.
Thanks, Miles. Thanks very much, and evening to your listeners.
So this is our third digitised census, 1901, 1911 and now 1926. But what do you think is the particular significance of the 1926 census release?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a coming of age for the Irish nation because it's the first since independence. And I think it'll show people, you know, the change that has taken place in Ireland in terms of demographics in the revolutionary period from 1911 to 1926, which is quite a long period of time. It's a demonstration, I think, of the new Irish government bedding into what would be kind of societal and democratic norms, that here is this fledgling state just a little bit over 3 years old taking up a census, bearing in mind there was a lot of people who felt that in Britain especially that this state was never going to succeed. And here it was taking up a census at a time when the population was dropping and economic activity was pretty much non-existent, and the country was coming out of a very divisive civil war, probably still in, to be quite honest about it, still in the middle of the trauma of that civil war, and really a difficult place to be. And then as well, I think this census will show clear movements with regard to religious change in Ireland, because you had in 1911, obviously, huge numbers of British military personnel in Ireland. A lot of those were moved back to Britain or moved north. So you're going to see a substantial change in terms of the demographics, in terms of not only the population, but as well as that in terms of the type of work that people had. And obviously then again, you know, which was characterised for the following 3 or 4 decades, the grip that immigration was going to start having, where families were literally starting to disappear. And I saw that in the case of my own family.
Now, it was a major act of faith. It was a major act of financial faith on the part of a government which basically didn't have a red rex, hadn't two pennies to rub together. But also it was huge social significance as well, wasn't it?
It was, but I think like you had that first Irish government, they achieved an awful lot in terms of, I suppose, the actually characterising the country as a proper modern European democracy. And since 1922, look, we have managed, come hell or high water, to be, I think, we're Europe's fourth longest continuing serving democracy now, which is no small achievement for a country where the population was dropping like a stone, the economic activity was pretty much non-existent. But they did take some fairly brave decisions, like, you know, the Shannon scheme was obviously the biggest one. But in terms of showing the population that they were prepared to carry out the administrative norms, actually putting numerators out on the road at a time now when, you know, the Civil War was very fresh in people's minds. You had an unarmed police force, which was obviously, I suppose, could be characterised as having had a particular allegiance because it was the Cumann na Gael government that was there, so it was the pro-treaty government that was there. But they still managed to take up a very accurate reflection of what Ireland was like in 1926. And of course, then it's the first post-partition. So particularly, I think it'll be interesting for border communities to see how partition actually impacted not only with regard to religion, but as well as that with regard to the economy, because you certainly get an indication from it. And the Irish language, of course, as well, is another one where you continue to see the number of Irish language speakers being challenged in terms of the anglicisation of Ireland and the impact that it has. So it's an invaluable piece of social history because it's true to form, it's very accurate, it's there in its entirety. And actually, the other thing which is kind of remarkable about it is some of the people that are entered into the census are still alive. And, you know, we have asked through the National Archives for people to put up their hands and say that, you know, that they'd be willing to be part of engagements or activities around the centenary. And obviously that's a matter for the National Archives. And look, we're taking the 100-year rule quite seriously, so we don't want to break anything with regard to the 100-year rule. But as a kind of an amateur follower of history, I'm very lucky to be in the department that I'm in because I love this sort of stuff. I was just there coming out before I left from the department, flicking through the Cork University Press Atlas of the Great Irish Famine. And I'm sure that this data, once it's released, we'll be able to form part of a fairly good anthology of what did the first 4 years of this independent Ireland look like, and was it what was characterised by the government at the time, or was a lot of that spin, or was it actually fact?
How big an investment of resources has the government made in the digitisation process?
So it's big. It's 5 million euros. It's not an insignificant amount of money for our department because we're one of the smaller departments. And compared to our nearest neighbours, of course, we're not charging people to have access to it. And that's really important from my perspective because these are the documents of the Irish nation. Like, the British made a decision to charge people for their own history, which I just think is a bit bizarre. I mean, their great-grandparents and their great-great-grandparents would have, in many cases, sat down with numerators to have their census records filled out. I don't believe anybody should have to pay for their history. People pay for enough in this country and they pay for enough in general. And having access to your birthright and, you know, your people's information for me is very important. And look, I said to you there before we started the show, in order for me to launch it, I better check the name of it again. The archives made me an officer of statistics. So I was able to see my own people's entries, the Whelans and the O'Donovans on my father's side. I didn't see the Kings or the Sheehans on my mother's side yet, but I look forward to seeing them. And I got an interesting bit of a lend, which was that my great-grandmother, who we always thought was from Limerick, was actually a Kerry woman. Yeah, she was Jane Corridon, which wouldn't be a big name in Limerick, but is a big name in North Kerry. And she's entered in the 1926 census as being from the village of Newtown Sands, which you now know, of course, is the village of Myvan. So I was down there recently opening a refurbished Garda station that when I was Minister for the Office of Public Works, we were able to give to the local community. And they were shocked when I said to them, well, I'm after being given on good authority from the National Archives and I'm actually one of your own. I'm one eight of Kerry men. So, yeah. So well, look, people are going to find things that they didn't expect. For instance, Jane Corridon. I knew my great-grandmother's name was Corridon, but I didn't know anything about her. But I now know she was from the village of Newtown Sands, which was the pre-independence name for Myvan. And my grandfather is there. His twin brother is there. I knew that they all immigrated. There was only two of them left in the country. So, you know, it's probably the only time that all of those O'Donovan children are ever recorded at the one place in the one time by officialdom. Because like every other family in West Limerick at the time, the spectre of immigration knocked on the door and it took them all to America.
Well, that's officially the first surprise of the 1926 census. It's the first, I'm sure, of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of surprises as people actually go online and look at their own family backgrounds. Minister, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The History Show this evening.
Thanks a million, Miles.
To talk more about the upcoming census release and what we might expect to find in it, I'm joined in studio by three guests. Orla McBride is the Director of the National Archives of Ireland. Ida Milne is a lecturer at Carlow College and visiting research fellow at Trinity College Dublin. And Gregory Walls is an historian and PhD researcher at Trinity who's been working on the 1926 census exhibition. You're all very welcome indeed to The History Show. And we're all very excited about about the digitization and the appearance online of the 1926 census. Orla, you are deep in preparation mode. You're looking at returns every day of the week. One of the things that's emerging, I think, for you, that's emerging of particular interest, is profiles of specific areas and institutions. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I think for the first time, I suppose, we're so in it in a way that maybe we weren't with 1901, 1911, and that we're doing everything in-house. So all of the cataloguing, all of the conservation, the digitization, and now the transcription piece, that's all been done by our own staff. So we're really getting a sense, and as you say, a profile of what Ireland looked like in 1926, where people lived and how they lived. So, for example, we only have two forms in 1926. So we only have Form A and Form B, unlike 1901 and 1911. So institutions are households. So it's no different from a farmhouse with a father and a mother and six children. You might have an institution, for example, the industrial school in Letterfrack. That is seen as a household return. The same with, say, St. Alton's Hospital in Charlemont Street. That, again, is seen as a household return. But then it's only when you begin to really interrogate them and study them that you begin to see differences. So, for example, I was looking at St. Alton's the other day and none of the children are named. So they're just given their initials, which is similar enough to 1901, 1911. But, for example, in the mental asylums or in the industrial schools, we're actually getting the children's names and the young people's names. So for Letterfrack, for example, you'll see the children. Some of them are as young as 1 and 2 years of age, both parents dead. You're seeing, so when a child below the age of 12, they're seen as scholars and they're written as scholars in the return. Anything over 12, then you begin to see young people actually having occupations. So in a cottage, say in Donegal or whatever, it would be the father's is a farmer, own account, and then the son who's 18 is working with the father, so he's put down as a farmer. In somewhere like Letterfrack and in the industrial schools, and you see it again in the other industrial schools, children as young as 12 and 14 are named as gardener or farmer. So you're beginning to see actually that there's industry within those institutions. The same with somewhere like Ballinasloe. You can see the profile of people from the local community who are working in the institutions, not only just as medical people or in an industrial school as a teacher, but you're seeing the gardeners, you're seeing the bandmaster, you're seeing teachers, etc., mechanics, people that actually support the kind of the industry around those institutions.
So just to backtrack on something that you said, only two forms, A and B, does that mean that we're going to get less information than we did in the 1901 census, the 1911 census? Because a lot of the really interesting stuff, if you kept on clicking, was in the ancillary forms.
You're going to get even more interesting stuff because in the household return now, so the A form, you're getting employer for the first time. We never had that in 1901, 1911. So you're really getting a sense, particularly in urban areas, of who were the employers and what did people do and how, and even in small rural communities, how people worked in the local drapery shop or, you know, the local grocery shop, or you can see cooperatives. So obviously, you know, we were, say, 30 years into the cooperative movement in Ireland. So you're beginning to see in communities, cooperative societies. So no, I mean, the employer piece is really, really interesting. The other piece for the first time in 1926 is people are being asked how much land they own. So people are given, so for example, a very, very, and I was looking the other day at a very, very large landowner in the Midlands had nearly 2,000 acres. But then I was looking at my own family in Gull Island and Donegal, and they'd all have about 1.5 acres. So you're beginning to get a sense of what rural and urban and those kind of the large landed areas look like. So, no, I mean, you're not getting things like whether somebody was an imbecile or, you know, but you're getting other pieces of really rich information that give that bigger kind of more that sense of what Irish life looked like and society looked like in 1926.
So slightly different information, but as you say, as rich as anything you'll find in 01 and 1911.
Absolutely.
And tell us about the scale of the archival and technical work involved in preparing the census for release.
So there are 2,500 books that are in the National Archives. So the first thing that we did was take the 2,500 books, and we had a team of archivists who catalogued them. And really, cataloguing is trying to get that high level information. And then once they all were catalogued, they went into conservation. And every single one of those 2,500 books, which was about 750,000 pieces of paper, went into conservation. And the books were disbound. So they're laced, and they had these gorgeous kind of buckles on them. And every one of the buckles had to be unbuckled. And the last time that they were buckled was by the guards when they were closing them up, and the Department of Industry and Commerce, when they were pulling all the information together. So that in itself was quite an extraordinary thing for us and a real privilege. So the 750,000 pages then went through conservation. Some of them were fine, so they were just surface cleaned. But then about 70,000 of them needed actual conservation work. And that might have been anything from just repairing a tear or a little damage, or flattening creases, or, and then, as I say, removing the surface dirt. So it took our conservation team 1,526 days to actually conserve the 1926 census. And then after the conservation, every single one of those pages was put through scanning machines that we had bought specifically for the 1926 census. So these high powered scanning machines, and they scanned, so they digitized every one of the images. And then they
That's
then...
what, 750,000 digital images?
Yes, were scanned by our staff. Then they went through the transcription process, and we used technology, which has been a huge, huge benefit to us. And we used OCR.
Did that include the dreaded AI?
Machine learning, we like to call it. optimal character recognition. And so the transcription software, really. Mm. And it went through those. And then we had a team of 50 staff, and they've literally been checking rows and rows and rows of data, because the machines make mistakes. So that's what they call the human in the loop. It would take one person 23 years to transcribe the 1926 census. So we're very grateful that those machines helped us along the way.
While overseeing all that work, you've also managed to edit, with John Gibney, a book, The Story of Us, Independent Ireland and the 1926 Census. That's coming next month. And Gregory and Ida are involved in that process. So Ida, the upcoming census release will intersect with your own research interests in a number of very interesting ways. You're a social historian of disease. You've looked at childhood illnesses. You've looked at child mortality in the 20th century. You've also studied, you know, famously, I think, the Irish experience of the influenza pandemic, and also the history of Protestants in Ireland. So you can see why you'd be interested in the 1926 census. But for your chapter in that upcoming publication, The Story of Us, you were allowed to choose one census return, and you picked one tenement building on Marlborough Street, number 34 Marlborough Street. Why did you choose that particular building? What was the interest there?
I literally couldn't wait to see that return. It's the house where my friend and former oral history interviewee, Stella McConnon Larkin, who was James Larkin's granddaughter, it's the house where her mother grew up. And her mother was Anna Moore Larkin, who was in the 1911 census as the only surviving child in that household. At that stage, there were three children born live. And Stella told me that in all, her grandmother and grandfather had 10 children. And her mother was the only one who lived over the age of five. So it was a story that really talks to me about death from disease, about poverty, about tenement living in Dublin at the time. And
but they weren't the only family, I presume.
No, they weren't. But they were very typical. So I looked at the rest of the families in that particular tenement when I got my hands on the census as well. But in terms of that family, what I'd managed to do with other records was to trace from the death certification and birth certification some of the other children that were in that family and where they were and what they died for. One, for example, died of diarrhoea during the 1913 lockout, while her sister's father-in-law-to-be was outside, you know, down the road talking. And one of them died in the 1918 flu. So I'm still looking and still trying to check whether Stella's, you know, memory of there being 10, because she was born long after these children had all died, whether that was actually true. So I've been using other digital records to patch it together. And I really, really wanted to see the return, to see how many children had been born live and how many were, you know, whether there was indeed only one still living then.
So you became, like the minister, you became an officer of statistics, but you were not allowed to roam around freely through the entire census.
Exactly. And what did I find? But that the family I was looking for were not there on the night.
so having chosen your tenement.
I had to make a story out of it then. So I looked at the other families to see what I could see. And like that, when Orla was talking about, you know, where they worked, you know, there were two young boys in one family. They both worked for different printers. So they won't just tell you what they do, what their trade is. They'll tell you also where they worked. They'll usually give an address. And if not, you go to Tom's and find the address. And then if somebody is not working, they have to say what they last worked at and how long they haven't been working for. And I found a woman in the house who had been a furniture polisher. She's now 70-something, but she was a furniture polisher. So she's putting that down as her trade. I found two other ladies who lived in the house. I think they were both single, but they went out through Rathgar to clean houses, and two different houses in Rathgar to clean. And they come all the way from Marlborough Street, which is a fair distance in those days. Every day to go out. So you're able to build a whole picture of the community. Another family in the 1911 census, they had lived in England for a time, but I didn't know where. Now, and the detail in this tells me where they lived in England. And you also get to know the counties that they were born in. So you're able to sort of build up a picture of even one tenement house, and just suddenly it's like it comes to life. It's cinematographic as you're reading the files.
And you've no idea, the family you were looking for, they weren't there on the night. You've no idea where they were. Presumably, you know, given the fact that they were living in a tenement in Marlborough Street, they weren't on a continental holiday, that's for sure.
Highly unlikely. I did trace the, Stella told me they were still living there in the 50s, and I did trace the mother's, her grandmother's death certificate, and she was still living at that address in the 50s. Mm. And I found some other records as well that suggest they were still there then. In fact, Anna Moore was married out of that house. So the marriage record was able to tell me that as well. So, you know, they were still there. So I can't wait for the 18 to find out where they actually were in the night. Maybe they were out of the country and I'll be flummoxed completely.
Yeah, this is one of the beauties of being an historian. It's called detective work, basically. Yeah, Gregory, the census, it was the first taken by the new Irish Free State. And to some extent, I think of it almost like the Doomsday Book, 1086 in England, as far as our state was concerned. What did carrying out a census mean for a state that had literally only just emerged from a decade of upheaval and where brother had been killing brother only 3 years beforehand?
This is a massive undertaking for the new Irish Free State, and there's a real sense of pride attached with the undertaking of that census and a serious amount of planning that went into it by the state. There was question marks over whether the 1920 Census Act could be used, and they decided, no, we probably can't use that British legislation. So we'll introduce a new piece of legislation, the Statistics Act, on the 12th of August 1925. It passes through the Oireachtas, eventually signed off on by none other than the King himself, George V, on the 18th of March. So there's a certain irony in all of that. But even that sense of pride is clear on the forms. You've got forms printed with, in big red lettering, make our census a success. So this is a real matter of pride for the state as they're planning it. You have about 2,000 enumerators across the country on Garda Síochána. Now, this in many cases would involve other members of the Gardaí from local stations, so it's probably more than 2,000. But there's a big operation involved in distributing the forms across the country. From the 5th to the 17th of April, about a 2 week period, forms are sent to every household across Ireland, and they're gathered as quickly as possible, particularly for institutions on the 19th of April, almost immediately, or for people who might have been travelling. So there's quite a big publicity campaign leading up to it as well. There was radio broadcasts. Employers, this new category in the census form, they were instructed to inform their employees on how to actually fill out the form, giving them advice and putting up posters. And there's some brilliant materials that we'll have in the exhibition.
And school children were taught how to fill it out.
Yes.
Is that because there was an anticipation that there still would have been some parents who were illiterate?
Quite possibly. I think that's one of the other things. You've got these changes to the forms that we think reflect a society that's changing, but you've got school children being advised on how to instruct their parents or to get involved in taking part in that process. And there's some cases where we can actually see, having gone through the forms, where it's clear that the handwriting is probably that of a child, particularly in more affluent households. So there's a real effort there to make people involved as a part of this process.
And was there a lot of, or were there a lot of instances where the guard would have filled out? Because you can see that
very
in
much
1901
so.
And in 1911, where man would have filled it out.
Particularly in areas where you have, I suppose, social class issues, where you've got particularly tenement housing, overcrowding, the forms are a little bit messier. So having gone through a lot of the forms, you can see the handwriting is a bit sketchier. The Gardaí are particularly putting on layers of information, particularly where people are not filling out the form with enough detail. So if there's extra layers that they want, such as who are your employer, if you're working for a farmer, how many acres does the farmer have? And often, as Orla has mentioned previously, the guard will be adding in that extra detail. But it's probably most pronounced in some Gaeltacht areas where you have forms that are completed in English for households that can only speak Irish. And that's filled out by the Garda.
And the census form was printed front and back. That must have been great fun for digitisation, I'd say. Was that to save money?
It presumably would have been, and it gives people the option to fill out the form in Irish for the very first time. So the form looks a little bit different. You have only space for 10 people's names to be recorded rather than 15. Although it's presumably an attempt to save money, there are a couple of instances of people writing on the back of the form where the Irish language section is in protest, saying this is a waste of taxpayers' money. Why are we having the Irish section available to people? Perhaps reflective of their own views on the world.
Orla, this is the first time, though, that people could fill out the form in Irish, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I suppose when we started the cataloguing part of this project, we really thought that we'd have far more in Irish, because we thought this is the first time that people can do it. So it would be a real statement in terms of our independence. And sadly, only 5,793 forms were filled out in Irish, which is about 1% of the population. But again, just to echo what Greg said, you can see it in rural communities. And I come from Donegal, and I could really see it when I was going through the Donegal ones, that people who were native speakers and would just say Irish only, they weren't filled out by them. They were filled out by the guard. Or I know my grandfather used to always talk about the census, that he would have filled it out because he was the teacher and he spoke Irish. And so around the townland where he was from, he would go from house to house to house and he would fill it out with the family. So you would have seen a bit of that as well. So yes, you know, but it's lovely to see the old Irish. Really difficult for the machines now, in fairness, to transcribe an old Irish.
The Irish D, for example,
Greek, basically. Yeah, and the H, or the lack of the H.
The bullshit.
But but it's lovely to see it. And as Greg said, there was a lot of kind of people doing it because this was their language, and then other people actually in protest saying, this is not my language.
Yeah, and Gregory, it's the first time that the literacy question was removed from the census form. Is that because the Free State government felt that there would not have been much illiteracy in Ireland in 1926?
That seems to be the most logical explanation for that. I suppose they have to make space for these new questions that Orla and I have mentioned. You've got the employment question, the land acreage question, the question about status of orphanhood, which reflects, again, the change in social demography since the war and the pandemic. But I suppose it does indicate that there's an assumed level of literacy across the country, I think. But at the same time, it's not quite as clear as they would have hoped.
And then talk to me about the demographics, the general demographics, age profile, ratio of men to women, that kind of stuff. What comes across from the census?
By and large, the 2,971,992 people on census
night. Just say 3 million.
Near enough. There's a decrease in about just over 5% in the 26 county area from 1911. Now, the numbers are a little bit skewed because we don't have Northern Ireland as part of this census. It's a separate
and they don't have the census themselves.
They don't have it anymore, no.
Yeah, it's a shame.
It's a real pity.
Because that was pulped in the second year in the Second World War, apparently. Yeah, okay. So general age profile, are we talking about a very young society, middle-aged, elderly society predominantly? What have we got?
Across all age groups, it's reported in the general report that it's largely unremarkable as a population, but you do see the ratio of men to women is exceptional across Europe. It's the lowest ratio of men to women. So you have 50.7% of the population is male, 49.3% is female. That is flipped from 1911, rather remarkably. And there's various different reasons for this. There's a concern about emigration, particularly of young women to America, but that's probably not the biggest reason. I think the removal of British forces after the Anglo-Irish Treaty from 1921, although you do have large sections of dependents from the war period still in Ireland, but it's that population change. You've also got the consequences of the flu and of World War One and the revolution as well. So it's a changing population. Mm. About 30% of the population are under the age of 14. So it's also quite young. But again, a lot of these people may not have parents or might only have one parent. 86% of the population have two parents alive, but you've still got 14% that have either one or no parents.
That's a sizable amount, isn't it?
Most definitely.
Yeah. Orla, what generally do we find out about employment, seeing as how that's one of the great boons of this census?
I suppose you see jobs that we don't see anymore. Things like an umbrella fixer or a caretaker of a dance hall or a tinsmith, or there's one, the crier to the High Court. Then you have lace makers and weavers and knitters in more rural areas. And then a huge number of, I think there were about 8% of the population who were domestic servants. So there's a, you know, you can really see that. Then you have like confectioners and bakers and motor drivers. So obviously we had, you know, automobiles had come in. So a lot of people were motor drivers in local areas. We even had like a gold miner who was returning from Canada.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely, with a bit of money. And then you had, like, we have a submarine cable telegrapher down in Cork. Like, then we have our tram drivers, etc. So, yeah, so you really get to see the different occupations that no longer exist. And one that we were very pleased to see and really look at in the National Archives was, it was Jacob's factory. You know, it was we were in the old Jacob's factory.
Of course, yeah.
So it was great to see the biscuit makers. And they even had people who were biscuit wrapper makers. So I was a biscuit maker and you were a biscuit wrapper maker. So, yeah, so that's the colour that's in the census returns, because not only are we asking people what their occupation was, but who they were employed by. That's what's really, really fascinating. And then, oh, there's some wonderful ones where we have, and there's a great note in it. We have loads of notes that are included in the census as well. So there's one from the Commissioner of Irish Lights, and that's in relation, because we had a ribbon of lighthouses around the country. So in Donegal, you'd have the number of lighthouses, or in Cork, etc. And but there would be a note in from the Commissioner of Irish Lights. We also have, like, for example, the enumerators were the Gardaí, and they were in the local community. So they knew who was who and what was happening, and they knew. So there was one, for example, where there was a man and he was maybe about 58 or 59 and he was a widower, and then he had a housekeeper living with him and she was 29, and then there was a boarder lad that was living there as well. And the enumerator appended to the return, because he had, so she, the woman was the housekeeper, he was the widower, and the enumerator appended to the return that it would be common knowledge in the town that perhaps she might be his wife and not his housekeeper. So, of course, we, you know, and I'm not an historian, but I see I am a detective now.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting for a family in Donegal, isn't it?
Yeah. I went looking and then all of a sudden found, yes, they had married the year before.
All right.
And then I looked and he had two children from a previous marriage, obviously. And then, of course, in the National Archives, we have all the probate records. So then I went looking to see what was in the will 20 or 30 years later. So that's the great thing, is that it will get people talking again and exploring and kind of excavating jobs and places and people and communities, etc. So the notes are really fantastic. There's another, finally, there's one wonderful note from Mountjoy Prison, from the ladies' prison. That return would be vague on specifics.
Mm.
So the governor of Mountjoy has included a note which says, look, we've included as much as they would give us, but they weren't going to go any further in terms of the information that they were given, because they didn't, you know, they saw this as the state. And obviously they were incarcerated. So, there was a bit of tension there with the state. So the governor has included a little note to say, look, we got as much out of them as we could, and that's all we can get. So the notes in themselves are great in terms of just that colour again, that they, and that extra layer of information that they provide.
Yeah, hopefully 100 years have passed. We're beyond embarrassment with with any of this stuff. I fancy that job. Umbrella fixer, I like that one. I could do that. Okay, we'll take a quick break now and we will be back after these. Welcome back. You're with The History Show. We're talking about the upcoming release of the 1926 census from the National Archives. My guests are Orla McBride, Ida Milne and Gregory Walls. Gregory, you've been looking at how the returns were analysed afterwards. Tell us about that.
So just as much as that initial laying out of the forms before the census, the taking back of forms and analysing them by the Department of Industry and Commerce was quite an undertaking. The forms were gathered up as quickly as possible. Some cases, forms weren't collected until early or mid-May. So it took quite a number of weeks, particularly from rural communities. They were brought into Dublin Castle, the lower courtyard there, and quite an interesting place for that work to be done. But that's where the Department of Industry and Commerce Statistics branch was based. The returns were annotated by staff based in the department. There's a total of 83 staff worked on the project, both men and women. So it was quite a large undertaking. In many cases, they have annotated all across some people's household forms in purple ink. So if people are looking at their family returns and there's scribbles and numbers and coding references, it can be a bit of an eyesore. But in many ways, it shows that this was a living piece of paper. This is a living document that was worked on. The staff then used tabulation cards or punch cards and quite sophisticated machinery that would have been used for the British census in 1921. So similar kinds of machinery. There's correspondence in the National Archives in January 1926 that says that they purchased 3.5 million punch cards to do this work. So it's quite an undertaking, and they take up 50,000 more during the course of the year. So that takes a number of years to work through. They produce these beautiful volumes, red covered volumes, which are the basis of the statistical reports that are freely available and have been freely available.
So these are our doomsday books.
Absolutely. And they're available on the CSO website. So they're publicly available. And that's kind of formed the basis of a lot of our initial work, looking through the forms and seeing what to look out for.
Fascinating. Ida, we'll stick with you for a little while, because we're going to cover two of your particular areas of expertise, flu and Protestants, right?
My favourite topics.
Your favourite topics, definitely. Okay, now we've talked before on this programme with you about the influenza pandemic. How will the census returns complement that research?
There are really endless possibilities there. You mentioned, Greg, I think, with orphans earlier. And now I can go back and look, because a lot of children lost two parents, or else I was told they lost two parents but couldn't verify it, because not all deaths go into the online death certification. So I will be able to trace those. I was doing a talk down in Rathkeel about a year and a half ago, and they told me that there was an entire laneway down there where not one person was alive after the flu. I haven't been able to trace that in the death statistics, but I will now be able to trace that in the census to see if what they're saying, which I'm sure it was true, and to see what happened. You know, how were those households changed? And I think there was about 10 households that were telling me that were just completely wiped out.
Yeah.
And that's something I haven't encountered anywhere else. The other thing really is that thing about orphans is because so many children were left orphaned after the flu. And I have countless oral history stories about those, will be to see how many other children that happened to. And in the death certification forms in other countries, they could actually trace that up quite easily. But we can't do that here. So it's great to be able to do it now in the census,
and then
to a certain extent.
The other big conundrum, because there have been, you know, it has been revised, re-revised, and this is the exodus of Protestants.
A great Protestant exodus.
From the Free State. Was there an exodus, especially in border counties?
Well, we all say, those of us who are in this great big engagement about this, we think it's a very complex question. And some of us have very simple answers and some of us have very complex answers. But if you read the abstracts that Gregory referred to there, they'll tell you that 100,000 Protestants, broadly defined, leave the 26. And they say very clearly that not all those are accounted for by being members of the police or the army or the British administration, that it's only about 25%. But on the other hand, you then have, like I've looked in the case of some of the big estates near my family down in Wexford, and you can see that some of the workers in the estate, particularly the household staff, were often probably English, and that they've left as well. So how many of those are we going to be able to trace?
And there's another phenomenon which hadn't even occurred to me, and that was Protestants actually moved south. Some of them did. Yeah. So you'll be able to trace them as well, won't you?
Yeah, I've come across, again, through my own friend circle, some families who came down south that didn't feel comfortable in the new administration separation and felt they'd be better off down south.
Now, Gregory, you and John Gibney looked at the revolutionary generation in the 1926 census. You focus on four people in particular. Who were they? Why did you focus on them? What did you find out about them?
So there are sort of, we worked on this on a couple of different levels going through the forms to see who we could find. And some of them are maybe the more familiar names on one on either political side of the political divide, so to speak, political figures. And you have to wait, unfortunately, until April to find out who they are. But what they do show us is kind of what we would expect about the political tension at the time, how they identify themselves. There's one broad trend that comes out is that a lot of the anti-treaty side seem to be starting to fill out the form in Irish. So there's a bit of a trend that I've kind of noticed going through the forms. Now, not all, not not all, but by and large, some of the bigger names tend to be doing. Again, this is around the same time that Fianna Fáil is being formed. So it's 100 years since the political party was formed. So it's quite an active topic at the time. So that's part of it. The other side of it is we have people who are caught up living their ordinary life, who might have gone off to fight in the First World War, who might have fought in the War of Independence or Civil War and changed political affiliation and stayed with the anti-treaty IRA. So there's one individual who's living in Dublin city centre, and he enumerates himself as formerly being employed by a tramway company, and he has to give up his work when he went to fight for the National Army during the Civil War. He then tries to get his job back. For one reason or another, he's not able to. He's two small children, two young girls, who he says he has to send them off to a convent school on the other side of the country. So he's unable to sustain the family because he cannot get a job. So you're getting some people who, for one way or another, are putting things on their census form that maybe isn't what's specifically asked of them. And in this case, it's crossed out by the enumerator. But you're getting a sense of what life actually looked like for people who might have had a political affiliation, feel that they haven't quite got something out of the state. Another incidence we have is a person who would be quite familiar, who decides to put a political slogan across the form and makes a case that I'm filling out this form on behalf of the Provisional Government of Ireland, but still fills out the form nonetheless, which is the interesting part.
And, I mean, one thing that's apparently something that particularly interested me because of my own research in the area of land, Patrick Hogan, Cumannagh-Wales Minister for Agriculture, who I knew to be pretty close to Kevin O'Higgins, didn't realise quite how close they were, because Hogan apparently, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway, Hogan spent the night of the census in Kevin O'Higgins' house.
I think it's widely known that Hogan, whenever he was visiting Dublin, would have stayed with O'Higgins. So I think that's, we can
safe enough.
Safe,
yes,
ground there.
Right, okay. So we don't have to, we're not breaking any embargoes on that one. Orla, tell us about the wider programme of events around this incredibly exciting launch.
Yeah, so in Ida and Greg's company, we have a book that's coming out. We have about 23, 24 different chapters that are looking at different aspects of Irish life from historians. So everything from Gaeltacht communities, looking at gender, looking at tenement living, looking at rural living, sport in Ireland, the arts, culture in Ireland.
And all the writers were conscripted as officers of statistics.
They were all conscripted.
Uniforms,
yes,
helmets,
yes,
the lot.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, yeah.
So the book will come out on the 18th of April, and also on the 18th of April we will open an exhibition in Dublin Castle, and that exhibition will also travel to London and to Boston, two centres really where the diaspora were really strong, and then the exhibition will travel around the country to 10 different counties as well as to the Ploughing Championships. And we also have a documentary that's coming out on RTE over two weekends after the census launch, which again is kind of looking at through the lens of individual people, looking at either particular occupations, particular family stories, or particular communities. We also then have a site-specific piece of theatre. We have a great old friend, Joe McGrath, whom we all became fascinated by during 1916. And he, you can track his life through records.
Is this Sweepstakes Joe McGrath?
Yes, it is.
Oh, yes, one of my least favourite people, I
yes.
have to say.
So we're doing a site-specific piece of theatre on the bowel Joe McGrath. Obviously, the Shannon Scheme...
I can think of other adjectives other than bowel, but carry on.
Because obviously the Shannon Scheme in Ard na Chruiche features quite largely actually in the 1926 census, and that there were 800 people employed at Ard na Chruiche, and just even looking at the number of Germans, etc., that had come over. And then we have a conference on the 4th of June in Dublin Castle, again looking at the census. What do we understand from the census? What do we learn from the census? And then what did the National Archives do to bring the census to life? So there's a huge amount happening. But I mean, ultimately, this is about people starting the journey themselves on the 18th of April, getting on the platform. And
is it going to crash?
I hope not. We're doing everything we can. I didn't realise I'd know so much about APIs and cyber testing and penetration testing and security testing. And that's the bit that, like, so much blood, sweat and tears have gone into it. And on the 18th of April, all people will see is a website. Mm. But actually, you know, it has convulsed the National Archives for 3 years. So, no, we're pretty confident that all will be right on the 18th of April.
And Are we going to have to wait another 10 years before repeating the giddy excitement of a census going online? Or do you think that the balance between privacy and public history might be revisited between now and perhaps the end of the 23rd or the beginning of the 2030s?
Well, that's a matter for the CSO, really, not the National Archives. But what's interesting is, as part of this process, we have discovered that there are 1,200 centenarians that we're working with, and we have a centenarian ambassadors programme. And there are 1,200 of them that actually were born on or before the 18th of April, 1926. So
there are 1,200 people who are in this census who are still alive.
And from a GDPR perspective, we had to reach out in as far as we could to ensure that they gave us permission to publish their personal data.
And they all did.
And they opt out.
Right. Okay, well, bless them for doing that, at least. Anyway, for all the details about the upcoming census release and the various events surrounding it, go to nationalarchives.ie. My thanks to all our guests this evening, Orla McBride, Ida Milne, Gregory Walls, Patrick O'Donovan, Zoe Reid and John Gibney. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Harry Buchtas was on sound tonight. Our researcher is Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Duncan, and producer Lorcan Clancy. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.